Good day, everyone. Can I have your attention, please? Thank you. Group in front. Thank you. Good on you. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Chris Shewbelt, the Associate Vice Chancellor in Melbourne and the Director of Libraries. I'm here to introduce this workshop. What do we mean by online learning, a systems perspective? And I'm particularly pleased to introduce Professor Alan Bowen-James, who's been with the university for 10 days, 8 days? Not a very long time, so this is a bit of a baptism of fire for you. Alan is the Associate Dean Learning and Teaching in the Faculty of Business. Alan comes to the university in general and to this workshop specifically with a very strong range of experiences. Alan has worked in teaching in a number of universities. He's worked with private providers, with peak industry groups and the like. I notice particularly, Alan, that you've had a connection with NextEd in a past life.
Indeed, I was going to mention that.
Yeah. And NextEd, as some of you would know, was where we launched ourselves into online learning many, many years ago now. So without further ado, I'll ask you to make Alan welcome and hand over to you.
Thank you very much. In fact, NextEd is where I'd like to start, because even though I just joined the university and I was invited shortly after signing up to participate in this conference, my association with the university really goes back over 10 years, because I was the chief operating officer of NextEd that put universities up online around the world. And among the various universities in Australia, you'd be familiar possibly with USQ Online and RMIT and La Trobe, and so it was ACU, and we got Blackboard installed here all those years ago. But even though the title of my talk focuses on technology, straight away I want to say my concentration is not technology, and that's for a number of reasons. In fact, I didn't even want to put a PowerPoint up, and I said I just use a whiteboard. That's why there's a whiteboard here, good old-fashioned technology. But I was advised that I really should have a PowerPoint, and there's a paper I'm working on at the moment, so I thought I'd cannibalize bits of that and you'll have a PowerPoint presentation of sorts, and Ingrid has very kindly offered her services to assist me in that regard, so that I'm not rushing from here to there and back. And so, the questions are welcome throughout, but if it's a long or detailed question or whatever, you might wish to wait till the end anyway, because I possibly could answer the question or address it en passant. When I said that I'm not focused on technology, I was reminded of this only a few months ago by a former student of mine who reminded me that many, many years ago, when the internet was starting to become a fad, we were playing with it, and I led an ARC funded research team on online databases, and so I'm going back now about 18 or so years ago. And my students asked, I'm talking about the mid-90s, when he asked this, what is the most reliable, robust information technology? And I said, the most reliable, and I say the same thing today, by the way, the most reliable and robust real-time online random access information storage and retrieval device is a book printed before 1600. Why? Acid-free paper. They're still around. Your DVDs will last maybe 30 years. They oxidize pretty quickly unless you keep them in a nitrogen environment. And that's hard, because you won't live in that environment, even though 70% of the air we breathe is nitrogen. The point is that we get too enamored of our technologies and end up concentrating on the technology rather than our practices, what it is we wish to achieve, the business rules of the organisations that we're in. Indeed, if I may say, there's a certain erotomania around our technology, such that as soon as we have a new gadget, the instant thought is, how do we adapt this to what we do, and so on. Now, that's creative, innovative, and so on, But often we forget what it is we're trying to do, and we end up distorting what it is we think we're doing or trying to do in order to accommodate the technology. So straight away, even though my title, somewhat misleading because it talks about systems architecture, is not actually misleading, because systems architectures are actually written on paper. When I did the initial design for ACU all those years ago with Blackboard, because our team was working on the best in what's now regarded as a primitive technology, pretty advanced in those days, we actually sat down and did it all on paper and worked out, and then we implemented. An architecture doesn't necessarily mean an advanced technology. It's all about the ways in which we connect the various elements that will converge, hopefully in an efficacious fashion, to help us achieve the ends we wish to achieve. In fact, I was asked, oh, you mean when you're talking about online, you're talking about e-learning? I said, no, that's what we used to call it years ago when we sent out CDs along with the books and so on. But, of course, if you wish to, we call e-learning. Well, no, we're okay with online learning. What would you rather call it? Distributed learning. And I want to talk about that today, distributed learning. So people might not understand that. I said, okay, I'm happy to stick with online learning and to use that term, providing during the talk I can actually talk about distributed learning, because that's what I mean. And what do I mean by distributed learning? In fact, this is a somewhat distributed learning exercise, in the sense that here we are, different folk from other geographies, but we've joined together in the one time and space in order to have some engagement. We're going to take down copies of this either orally or some script or whatever and take it away, and then in one way or another we'll engage with it later. That's actually quite tight. Of course, once you then start doing this over the radio, over the TV, over the internet and so on, the pattern of distribution changes, the pattern of interaction alters. But in fact, one of the important things with respect to what's called online learning, or indeed distributed learning, is that the systems and the technologies are available for us to choose the variety of ways in which we wish to engage both each other, third parties, and various resources. So, the real system architecture I'm going to talk about, and then we can look at all the PowerPoint stuff which I was obliged to do, is really as simple as this in some respects, but of course, as we know, simplicity is always terribly deceptive, and please allow me to use some old technology, because it not only reflects my history, but also the fact that in some ways it's just so much easier to communicate with people with something simple. When we talk about distributed learning, we're not just talking about the impartment and dissemination of knowledge and the way in which that knowledge is incorporated by individuals. In an academic environment, we're often talking about four key elements. One, whether we appreciate it or not, is called marketing. Letting people know about the message, whatever it is. That's whether we're talking about ACU as an institution, a particular faculty, a particular course, a particular unit, or in fact, even getting the message out about, I'm really serious about plagiarism. And I'm really serious, and my message is, I'm not going to be soft or whatever it is. Right? In other words, one way or another, you're getting a message out. These are your primary high-level communications. One way or another, whatever form of distributed learning you're engaged in, there's always a marketing element. In this quadrant, there is always a customer relationship element, a service element. We call student management systems. In business, they call them customer relationship management, CRM systems. If you get very sophisticated in business, sometimes they're even built into your enterprise resource planning, and SAP has its whole CRM. But one way or another, this is all about capturing the data that you get related to your key stakeholders. Remember, you've got to communicate with them one way or another, various levels. And of course, you've got to have that data, knowing who your audience, your stakeholders, your participants are. Remember, this is all about the learning environment, because learning primarily is about engagement in the first instance from both the teachers and the students' perspective, or the teacher and the learner's perspective, but especially is about an understanding of what it is we think we're doing. See, because as was said in that excellent talk this morning by Sally, most education, most learning takes place outside of the classroom. We all know that as educators. We communicate, we have customer services. In our student management system, what we have is essentially a permission-based system. So we've got messaging going back and forth there, and we call this a student management system, called various other things. Now, somehow, here we have all this data about students, and we want to interact with those students. In the e-learning slash online world, if we're talking about web-enabled, we'll talk about this as an LMS. That's primarily what Blackboard is, of course. Others call it a virtual learning environment. I prefer to call it a managed learning environment, because, in fact, a classroom is a managed learning environment. Whether it's in cyberspace or in this room, it's still a managed learning environment. Managed in terms of the expectations, certain protocols, certain etiquettes that are associated with it. And of course, there's communication this way. Why? Do you let anybody walk into that environment? Well, sometimes you do, but if you've got paying customers and if your budget's of concern to you, maybe you won't. So indeed, there's a permission-based system going back and forth. But of course, there's intellectual property here. It's not just a question of people entering either a physical space or a virtual space without access to a whole host of resources that either the teacher uses or the student uses, whether they're called libraries, books, YouTube, you name it. So one way or another, you have what are called content object repositories, databases. In the new world of online distributed learning, they're content object repositories. Now, when we talk about distributed learning, what we're saying, among other things, is that these elements need not be in the one spatio-temporal location. We know that even with our classroom. The libraries aren't in our classroom. Funnily enough, with modern technologies, we have a degree of convergence that makes propinquity in terms of our resources possible. We can be closer to each other in this space by using imported and then exported technologies than we ever were in a traditional classroom where somebody had to physically leave the room to get the learning element, the book or whatever. With these new technologies, there is essentially a new, when I say paradigm, I'm terribly overused word, but when one says this, I say it carefully, there is a new way, and there has been abroad for many years, new way of interacting that in fact many educators don't appreciate anywhere near as much as their children do, as I learn from my three daughters about education every day, as I become more and more antique for them and quaint in terms of all this, and they see daddy struggling to keep up with all the technologies and so on. Even though I hold a few papers in. Anyway, in terms of the way in which we're talking about online learning or distributed learning, we're talking about elements that can be all over the spatio-temporal world, but it's all about points of convergence. The architecture is what makes it happen. The enabling technologies will be adapted, discarded, rediscovered in various cycles according to all sorts of fashion. If we put to one side the technology, whether it's our iPod, our iPad, our iMac, or whatever it is, the thing is, and understand that the architecture which is based on our business rules, the logic of what it is we intend to do, as long as we appreciate that and understand that technologies are only enabling devices, will we ever understand how we can adapt these various distributed technologies to meet our distributed learning needs. And at long last, I may as well use the PowerPoint, this other technology, which now seems so outdated. And in fact, we can go past all that because otherwise we're concentrating on the text. But really, a few things that I want to point out. Technology should not be the enabler. Key message, if you take nothing else away from today, is don't worry about the technology. That's secondary. It's your so-called business rules that should dominate. When I say business rules, I'm not talking about commerce as such. I'm talking about whatever business it is you think you're in, such as imparting knowledge to a student. Systems integration. The actual technology itself is secondary, yet again, to the way in which it's integrated. We all know this. Even on our humble PCs on our desktop, we use a fraction of the percentage of the capacity of those beasts because, A, we don't know how to, and B, they're not actually integrated in our work and life and other practices so that we have the wherewithal to use them. And importantly, with good architecture, we have agility. We can move on to the next one. Why is agility important? Well, I just thought I'd put a few things up here to talk about a distributed learning environment and the various things we have. Spoke about student management system. You see, when it's all like that and it's not organised, it's pretty hard to understand. What do we think we're doing in this online environment? Hence the importance of that. Well, we know we've got logistics. We know we have enterprise resource planning. We have to be fed and somebody has to organise all of that. Somebody has to do it. Student management system, well, we all had to be accredited or whatever it was to get here. Resource management, we know about that. Customer relation, all of this. Let's go to the next one. Somehow they've got to be connected. In the early days, we were very focused, and this is very much what, say, Blackboard is. It's a toaster compared to a bread maker. What it does is it takes a predefined object, piece of bread, it'll do something, it'll warm it up nicely for you, and here it is. All the parameters are largely set. What we're moving towards in distributed learning nowadays, and in technology broadly speaking, in a variety of enabling technologies in other areas, I won't go into the bread makers, namely, you make the bread, and you get it just the way you want, and you'll be able to toast it just as you like. In other words, what is happening with distributed learning technologies and online technologies is that we're finding more power is moving into the hands of the individual users, students, teachers, administrators, quality assurance folk, and others. And you know what? They're making the bread. And they're toasting it in different ways. But it's important that it's all held together. System commoditization. What does that mean? Well, it's very interesting. I did part of an MBA at Deakin and I did the other part at Stanford. And you know what? The notes were better at Deakin than at Stanford. They would become commoditized. We all know that, textbooks. I used to be with Thomson Corporation. You're familiar with Thomson textbooks, called Cengage now. And so I used to be their general manager, Asia Pacific in education. We all knew what was happening with textbooks, of course. And indeed, the choice between one or the other, well, it's often a very idiosyncratic decision, whether you go with McGraw-Hill or with Thompson for this, that, or the other. They become commodities. But system commoditization has enormous impact on the systems themselves, but also the choices you make. You see, the thing is, if somebody says, oh, you did your MBA at Deakin, that's okay. Oh, but you were also at the Sloan School. Yeah, but you know what? The Deakin stuff was, you were at the Sloan School, you were at, yeah, but you know, the Deakin, if I have to compare this, you were at the, so the point was, of course, that the brand dominated, and what Deakin had to offer, yeah, that's an MBA, and that's commoditized. And the materials and stuff. I thought, of course, the Rolodex factor is standard for something else, but that's another story. We have to understand commoditization because managed learning environments, LMSs, have become commoditized. Last time I did a survey of them and had to review them in a commercial capacity, there were about 600 that were quite reasonable. And there must probably about another, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 out there that are, you know, dodgy brother stuff, but it still works and so on. And there may be millions more out there in backyards and garages and so on. So the question again is there's no problem about choice. The problem is the decision you make today is going to live with you for years, decades. So be very careful about the choices you make and why you make those choices in a highly commoditized environment. Not need to worry about that. Let's go to the next phase. In fact, I'll move on because I want to give us more time to talk. And let's go to the next if we could. Now, early days, right? Ancient history stuff. We all had student management system. They even had them in the 19th century. Thompson used to own a thing called the International Correspondence School, started in Glasgow in the late 19th century. And I was amazed to see a student management system in Glasgow when I went there from the that had been built in 1896. And a card system, quite automated, quite impressive. Logistics, we know about that. Got to get the learning management system, Blackboard, and so we have all that. Content authoring tools, various sorts of things there, Microsoft Office, right? And library resources. And of course, what happened is that these things started to get connected in as these systems started to become more tightly integrated. We started to link student management, student data with logistics, and learning management with learning content management systems. Now, I could get very technical here, but essentially, this is the content object repository I was referring to. Somewhere, the content has to live somewhere. In the early days with Blackboard, things have changed a little bit, not that much. It's essentially an LMS, a very good one for its time. But LCMSs have actually grown independently. And in fact, can do a whole host of things that you'd never dream of in there because they're purpose-specific systems. Yes. Well, you know, time went by and we found we could do a lot more things and things started to get a bit more connected. Right? The library resources were brought in and you could do that. And of course, synchronous classrooms. Because again, we know that, but when I use the term synchronous and asynchronous, we are having a synchronous exchange because in the same geography, it doesn't even have to be that, but it's in the same time zone. We are talking contemporaneously. If it's asynchronous, it's like me sending an email, which you may respond to 5 days later, or leaving a voicemail for you. We need not be in the same time space in order to communicate. So synchronous, classroom event is a classical synchronous activity, email is a classical asynchronous activity. And of course we see things starting to be connected. But you see, not everything, we go to the next one. And then of course, we start to see our different systems. Because you know what, the library will have its own system and we have to connect to that. And then we have to connect with some other system, and then there's a quality control system and so on. And then we start using various tools for that. Don't want to get too technical. So that then led to other things being connected and e-portfolios. We keep on going. Till eventually, all that mess that we had before, if we could go back a little bit, see the, just, yeah. See, what's happening, no, back, oh, great, thank you. What's happening is you're starting to see what always happens when you get a plethora of little subsystems of doing quite nicely on their own, thank you very much. Eventually, it starts to become a bit chaotic because organizing all of this becomes a real headache. Then we move on. So what we start to do is create virtual sets, brackets. We create environments and we call it a portal. Okay, we go through the portal. What would happen is that we capture various elements. And importantly, these would have to be standards determined. And bless the US Department of Defense, because remember the driving force of the internet, we wouldn't be here talking about web stuff if it weren't for the US Department of Defense. But funnily enough, there's a story many years ago, it tried to offload the non-defense and non-scientific research aspects of it to AT&T and said, look, for I can't remember how many, 10, 20 million, you can have the damn, what would we do with it? right? I mean, this, of course, was in the 80s. Remember, the internet was actually technically invented in 1968. 1968, there was a fully functional internet for the US Department of Defense for a very specific defense purpose. And people forget that the Americans gave this to the world. It was literally given. And then they tried to sell for a few million bits of it. AT&T ended up buying a few percent, 7 or 8%, I can't remember, for so many billion a few years after it turned down the whole thing, essentially, for just for its Amex, you know, account. Anyway. The US Department of Defense set standards. That, why? Because it's still the world's biggest distributed learner. It's still the world's biggest user of online learning technologies is the US Department of Defense. If you have a few students, you try training simultaneously 1.7 million people in various programs, often high-tech, high-security environments. So they created a portal structure using standards. The important thing here is that all these elements relate through a variety of standards that allow the elements to talk to each other in a highly collaborative but coordinated way. And what you're starting to see is the advent of what's starting to become familiar to all of us now in terms of the portal structure that we associate with traditional online or distributed learning. There are still elements outside, but they relate. Yep. Hi, that's just a lot of bump about standards. Don't worry about that. And if anybody's interested in what LDAP is and all that, we can talk about it. It's not really relevant. Let's go now. Okay. So let's some interesting stuff here. What we start to see is that once we set the standards right, the standard that the US Department of Defense uses that's now worldwide, that even Blackboard had to adopt, called STORM, is one where you have a system here and you can start interacting with other external elements. We've got YouTube and so on. Fascinating stuff that's occurring now. When I did this, whenever it was, I thought, well, I won't put in the stuff about e-textbooks. And it's just funny. It's funny that only a night, two nights ago, a former colleague from the US said, look, it's going to occur in the next few weeks, and I can't give any details, blah, blah, blah. But you're going to see a deal's been signed where we're going to stop selling a whole bunch of textbooks as paper, and essentially they're all going to be integrated with learning management systems. By the way, Blackboard's one of the parties that's got deal, and there are many others, and so on. And of course, I'll talk about open source later if people wish to. I'd love to, but not in context of this, because I don't want to concentrate too much on the specific technology. But again, so I could add textbooks here as well. The traditional paper-based textbook, of course, we all know is a dinosaur. But that's a dinosaur. Remember, they were around a lot longer than our species, and so we should be very respectful of dinosaurs. And they will be with us yet, because remember, technology always has, to a certain extent, fairly long lead in time, though that, of course, is becoming compressed. But what you're seeing is a number of external elements that we'll never want to bring within the portal structure being incorporated, but always staying outside for a whole host of reasons, from intellectual property, security, but all sorts of, I just don't want them there, they're too big. Right? So what happens is you'll say, well, I'll have a little chunk of YouTube, so do what University of New South Wales does, for example, have many of its lectures on its own YouTube channel, all universities, many universities, I should say, are doing this. So, next one, please. And of course, it gets a bit more complicated. We can go to the next one, that just has a slight variation on it. Till eventually, what you're seeing is that multiple portals start to get connected. And various universities, the Australian Technology Network is doing that, but also when I was asked to consult with a private provider a number of years ago, we did this. We actually have various institutions that have their own portal, but they come back to one centralized system that now handles thousands, tens of thousands of students. This is a private institution. And it runs, each one has its own branding. Each one has its own special permission, so the sessional staff here and so on can't get into that, and the students from here can't get into that, unless they've got permission to do so. But they work off the one back end. Now, in a highly distributed environment, such as ACU, I mean, we talk about distributed learning, ACU is quintessentially distributed learning, even if only geographically. This is very, very compelling. And of course, the student management system works across all, making sure that everything's, and you can still link with all your external resources.
That's cool.
And then, of course, there's no reason why you would want to stop all of this. This other private institution had linkages into other parts of the world, and they had their own system, and of course, you can link all of that. When I'm talking, these are big institutions, but you know what? You could just as well do this for a class. Within a faculty and other faculties, if you wish to, for your combined degrees, or whatever it is you wish to do. Now, this has got a whole host of motherhood statements, beginning of a long journey, and all that sort of stuff. We needn't worry about that because it'll take away time. But let's go to the... just the next thing, right? There is an evolutionary path here. And we have to actively engage it, if not necessarily pursue it, both strategically and tactically. The evolutionary path is towards complexity at one level, commoditization and the massive choices that commoditization entails. But also, we now have tools to simplify, or at least, if I can say, organize that level of complexity that will allow us to do things in much smarter way than prima facie we think we could, given the enormous complexity confronting us. For example, if we go back a few, thank you so much, Ingrid. If we go back a little bit. Okay, here, that's good, thank you. This looks so daunting. When you get down into the detail, designing is... I did the high-level design for the Stock Exchange Knowledge Bank system. Many of you are familiar with any of that. They've got a learning management system. They had to get 32,000 stockbrokers and other folk involved in a highly secure environment that had to go through numerous firewalls, and they all had to be able to control and distribute intellectual property in a secure socket layer that any bank or Fort Knox would be proud of, and yet it had to be fairly open. Now, the challenges there we thought would just be impossible. How could you do this? Oh, and we want you to connect people all over the world because we want to get into the New York Stock Exchange, Frankfurt, of course, you know, naturally, and you know you could just see the list going, and so this was quite a challenge. In fact, what we found was that through properly modelling the system, that things had evolved to the point where there were now meta tools that we could use where robotically they could handle the lower level of complexity and indeed allow us to get on with other things. And the interesting thing is it was a bit like island hopping. What I mean is this. During the Second World War, of course, you didn't want to take every single island in the Pacific occupied by the enemy, so you'd go to the strategic ones and you'd get back to the others when they were sufficiently starved that they'd want to surrender or whatever, right? So you would island hop, right? Well, you do a lot of that. That's called agile computing. You do a lot of island hopping and you backfill, providing that you have the appropriate technologies that allow you to give you sufficient comfort, that you can actually do this and come back and understand what it is that's happened. So believe it or not, it's a bit like medicine, where you open up and have a look. But meanwhile, remember, you've got a steaming abdomen open in front of you. You'd better do something quickly, because you don't really know what's going on till you see it. And then you have to make the decision whether you're going to take out those 4 feet of, pardon me, my antiquity, a meter and a bit of bowel, and what it is you're going to do, right? So what it means is you do a lot of diagnosis, wishful thinking and prognosis, but you have lots of good techniques and tools and sufficient knowledge to know that you handle these systems as they emerge. Can I tell you what's fascinating with what's happening with a lot of the systems in the internet? Google is fantastic. It's why Google still has a tremendous advantage over many others. And it's very interesting. I was talking to, oh, this is going back now a year or so, to one of the chief mathematicians with one of my doctorates in maths education. So talking with the mathematician about the algorithms. And some of the algorithms are so complex, and because the intellectual property is held so tightly, they don't just put it on a table, so to speak, and say, here you are, steal our IP, join another company, and that's it, goodbye Google. They don't do that. What they do is only maybe three or four people know the whole algorithm for any particular thing, and they divvy it up. And they do that island hopping thing where you know this and you know that and you can connect that, but you won't know this, this and this, and just take it on faith it'll work, because we've designed the system that is self-organizing. Now what we're finding with the system, with the internet, is, and this is occurring with the increasing complexity of data and the processes being put on it, it is and it will be increasingly in the future self-organizing. And you know what? When the first internet protocol was first devised back in the 60s, it was because, why? Well, in the event of a nuclear war, we won't know what servers are around and there won't be people to maintain this. So the original design for the protocol assumed a self-organizing system, and a bunch of mathematicians sat down and said, how could you set up a system that essentially, providing you gave it juice, you know, you fed it, you kept the electricity on and all of that somewhere, it could keep running itself. Well, we've reached that stage in the internet. When I spoke to the senior Google folk about what they knew of what was going on within server farms, and when I talk of server farms, you see aircraft hangars out there, you know, not nearby. Imagine those many, many, many times larger, with thousands of servers, all doing so many megaflops a second in terms of computational processes. They have no idea. Only at the highest possible level. That strayed a little bit from what we were talking about before, but that was really just to talk about the level of complexity we could go into back into distributed learning environments. What's the relevance of what I just said then to distributed learning environments? To a certain extent, what happens is once you open up your learning environment so that folk are able to a large extent self-serve, because you've got fairly automated systems one way or another that are providing you with material, your assessments are going back and being automatically marked or whatever it is that's happening, you are moving between this, that and the other, someone's in Ulladulla, someone's in Ulaanbaatar, but you're in the same class somehow with a teacher from Nebraska, wherever it is, what it does, eventually, of course, what you find is that you lose control of that system very quickly unless you have built self-organizing principles into it. And that's one of the key things that we learn when you come back to a very basic distributed learning system architecture. At some point, the key messaging, the marketing, the comms, the management, the customer relationship, or your stakeholder relationship, who are the individuals or entities, I mean, let's not be species specific here, even carbon compound specific, the entities that will one way or another participate, given what I've just said, most of them would be silicon compound, the portal, so-called, as I've mentioned there, the managed learning environment in which this will operate, and of course the intellectual property. Now, the take-home message, or messages. One, we're talking about distributed learning. The technology is not secondary, it's tertiary. That sounds crazy because it's so important, but it's tertiary. Because what you've got today that just absolutely infatuates you'll be old hat tomorrow. The question is, how does it all connect? How does it meet your particular needs? Second aspect, you build for scalability now. Work towards a stochastic future. Linus Pauling, when he got his first Nobel Prize in chemistry, or his first Nobel Prize was in chemistry, his second wasn't, had developed the science of stochastics. What that means, and that's incredibly important in advanced IT, as well as chemistry, is this. When you start a particular chemical process, you don't actually know it will end up exactly at this point. You only know it when it's a certain percentage away from the beginning. It's reached a certain stochastic threshold, And it's only at that point, you know, 1 minute to midnight, that you know what's going to happen, which way it'll go. The internet is a lot like that. Learning is always, education is always about that. It's a stochastic process. Our learning outcomes, our graduate attributes, can you predict from the day you start teaching a student what the outcome will be? But you'll have a very, very good idea a few days before they graduate. That may be your stochastic point. What we try to do as educators is bring that stochastic point back further, so we can intervene more if we think it's going somewhere we don't want it to go. When we design distributed learning systems, any sort of system such as this, what we try to do is build it in such a way that wherever possible, we have some sense of where our stochastic points may be and where the future may actually reside with all of this. Getting back to the old technologies and Blackboard, if we can go back a bit, thank you, you're so kind. Let's keep going. Keep going. Back. Oops. There we are. Frankly, this is called getting personal, because I was involved in building that system. At the time, it looked so wonderful, I can tell you. In fact, outside of Blackboard in the States, we were the only group allowed to fiddle with their assessment engine. For what was then called Blackboard 6, as you know, Blackboard took over WebCT and all that sort of stuff. And the reason you might ask yourself, in this environment, in this world, where this stuff's burgeoning, how come these companies keep collapsing, and how come Blackboard itself is only worth a few hundred million on the stock exchange? I mean, it's not a multi-billion dollar company. Why? Because everybody else out there is doing all this other stuff, and you know what? It's getting commoditized, and it's cheaper, and so on. A system that was designed and did very well what it was supposed to in those days cannot compete, or I shouldn't say that, maybe it can, but cannot necessarily compete going forward with systems that at the very least can do this, and keep going forward, if you could just a bit more. And keep going, we'll keep going. Actually, I should have organised this better, but I did this, so to speak, very quickly the night before. They said it's got to be in because that can do that. Speaking now with an ACU hat, my fresh ACU hat, we need to be able to build for this at the very least and all the other stuff I mentioned before going forward. We need to have a strong sense of our architecture. Why are we architecting in that way? Question?
I know that you didn't give me time to ask, but I just jump in because what my understanding is, a self-managed system, what you're talking about, can a system substitute you in self-managing this PowerPoint presentation, what you swapped so many times? Can a system do that?
No.
You see, compared to what you did now?
It's a good point. In the same way as you can have remote surgery, you can have computers programmed. But you know, at some point, the computers have to be programmed. It's very interesting.
Programmed by you and me. If I don't have the algorithms,
yes,
the computer just acts based on my algorithm.
That's right.
My algorithm is what is self-rewarding, but not the computer.
If we're talking, I mean, obviously now we're getting into the world of wild speculation and cybernetics and so on, but the point is fundamentally correct. And that is, obviously, we as carbon compounds have a distinct advantage at the moment because our processing power and our particular histories and so on are such that we still run the show. Will that necessarily be the case a century or two from now? That I can't tell you. What I can say is, if you look at the way things are trending, we'd better start learning smarter. If you're saying someone could replace me and do a better job, or an entity of some sort, I have absolutely no doubt about that. Would that entity at this stage do the base planning that would set the systems up? At this stage, no. They're very, very, very good at working beyond. I'll give you a perfect example. Perfect example. Nobody here can calculate the way a little handheld calculator can. No? Nobody here can. No? But calculators don't design themselves. And it's very interesting. That's not even so important. You know why? We didn't evolve that. I'm getting back to that, use the evolutionary point. All we had to know was that mammoths were coming at us. Did somebody say, look, was it 23 or 24 mammoths? I don't know, Charlie. Will that make a difference? Some squash, right? No. The point is that we just had to know one or more mammoths that might make a difference to us, and that could we react accordingly. The thing is that at this stage, what I'm saying is even with such systems as this, the fundamental design, but more importantly, the understanding of what the system is supposed to do, and all those other seeming intangibles, the qualitative aspects that are so much harder to capture in a computational environment, that's where, fortunately, thank you, we still hold the edge, and I believe we will for some time to come. But I think what you've said as well has important pedagogical implications, and that is, it's too easy to rely on the technology to do the work for us. And I think one of the hard things for teachers, for educators, is actually to temper the technology. As much as I love online and been involved in doing all that and set up universities and so on with it over the years, frankly, I much prefer to talk to people face to face. I much prefer the intimacy of human interaction. But you know what? It's wonderful if you can use the technology to help you do the things that you do repetitively and so on, that are labour intensive, that have a high opportunity cost. You know, it takes forever to get here and I'm wasting all this time sitting at a lecture that I could have to look at online. You know what's interesting? Queensland University in the med school has done something quite fascinating. A few years ago, John Hay, my old boss from many, many years ago, when he was VC Deacon, he went up there and basically the med school said people are wasting their time in classrooms for stuff that's not important. So he said, you know, can you work with us and do something in terms of, these are on-campus med students. Now medicine's one of the most hands-on subjects, you get with disciplinaries, you can imagine. I suppose Swedish massage more, but medicine will do. So the thing is that so many of the lectures and the tutorials were a waste of time for many people. What did he say? I didn't hear. I know she was talking, saying, you know, all three students always dominate the tutorial and all that sort of stuff. So we found, using tons of evidence, that actually putting certain learning events into an online environment actually was an equalizer. Gave people who had either learning difficulties, language difficulties, or whatever, the opportunity to over and over, do all sorts of things, a great quality control mechanism. You know, what was the lecture like for you? You said, oh, we had a cold, he was feeling lousy, it was terrible. No, it was great today. He got over the cold, and you don't have that problem, right? But you know what you need to do in medicine? Sometimes you really do have to labour over that cold body in pathology. You really have to see those histopathology specimens. You really have to talk to a patient. Heaven forbid it does happen. So what happens is that you take out the resources and all the effort and the opportunity cost associated with unnecessary face-to-face interactions, and you invest a massive amount of time and effort into getting particular learning events right. You maximise the potential of propinquity, of direct human interaction, and all its idiosyncrasies and foibles. And that's fantastic. And that's really what we're looking forward to, I think, in the future. We use these technologies and systems and everything to free us to do things like this if we think this sort of encounter is important. And the other stuff we do when we can. Because remember, we live in a world now where our lives are not as neatly compartmentalized as they used to be. Now, I'm just in school now. I'm at university now. Well, what does that mean? Well, sex, drugs, rock and roll, champions, and the other. And occasionally I get some learning, and then I'm going to get a job, and that's it, and so on. The good old days. Right? Most increasingly, people are going to be working and learning and having their kids and all the things they're going to do, and they're going to try and fit various activities into the spaces. So these enabling technologies, the distribution of learning is not just going to be spatio-temporal, it's going to be internalized in our lives. We learn in the office, we're going to be learning after hours, we're going to be doing all these things, and indeed we use these technologies in order to facilitate that. But back to your fundamental question earlier on, I think we'll still be doing that, and hopefully the technologies will be enabling, not controlling us.
When you're talking about this, yesterday I was reading an article about how we live in different compartments. We have to perform multiple roles as a human being. And I was writing a paper and read something like how work interferes with family, but whatever happens in the family less impact on work, because family has so much of permeability to play on with different roles and, you know, give it to someone else or not do it, whereas at work you can't. And you know exactly, because of all this technology, students have so much of permeability to play with their education, they don't take it seriously at all.
The first aspect of what you said I think is very interesting, and there's a lot there in terms of the permeability of the various compartments, so to speak, virtual compartments in our lives. To say that students don't engage because of the technology is all the data as opposed to that. If you look at any of the research worldwide and stuff that I've looked at, I only recently returned from Europe.